Thank you, Ben. Super excited to be here this morning and talk to you about blockchains. In 2001, Nick Szabo, a legal scholar and a cryptographer, a computer scientist, who was among a group of activists that tried to invent cryptocurrencies and create, you know, anonymous payment systems that will resist any government and any regulation and any centralized control. And he coined the term smart contracts. These are contracts, business contracts, that self-execute and self-guarantee their properties with the message, centralized services are a security hole. You may agree or disagree with this bold statement, but today we're going to talk about a technology that allows you to build decentralized, trusted services. And the three takeaway messages from this talk will be, first of all, at the core, this technology is something that the academic world knows as state machine replication, consensus. We understand it very well. Secondly, there's a lot of exciting innovation and new ideas in this space, but still a lot is lacking. And third, we'll talk about some ideas and some technical deficiencies that need to be addressed in order to mature this technology. So jumping right in, what is a blockchain? So when you look at the cryptocurrency world, the technology actually has two parts. One is the digital currency aspect of it, which is not the focus of this talk. The other is a technology called the blockchain that allows tracking the history of spendings of payments. And this is the core enabler of cryptocurrencies, and this is the focus of my talk. So to give a technical point of view on this technology, I use these three layers. At the bottom is the core. This is a decentralized ledger that keeps a history of payments. These could be transactions or spendings or something like that. And the idea is that a group, a large group of users, everybody, keeps a copy of this history so everybody agrees on the sequence of spendings or of transactions. Now, a ledger is a technical term that comes from the financial world. Every bank, every financial institution has a ledger of transactions or updates. But here we're talking about a technology, an engine that keeps a decentralized view of this ledger. On top of this engine, there's a language and semantics for expressing these payments, these transactions, and giving the meaning to the data which is stored in this ledger. And on top of that, people build services, applications, and there's a ton of them, and many things that can be done with this. So this is the core technical point of view of what a blockchain is. And of course, us as a systems community, as a distributed systems experts, we refer to this as state machine replication. This is just how to replicate a service. You agree on a sequence of updates and you apply them to the same state. Everybody starts with the same state and apply the same sequence of updates to it and generate some kind of a distributed application. However, if you go to the fintech leaders, you know, the executives at banks and so forth, and you tell them, hey, I have a cool new technology that solves state machine replication, you'll have a very, very short discussion. So instead, we use, you know, ledgers and blockchains, and this is the cool new terminology to discuss this. Now, state machine replication or a distributed ledger, let's look at examples of how that actually solves the decentralized trust problem in two of the leading examples out there, Bitcoin and Ethereum. So if we peek inside a ledger, if we look at the entries that are stored on a Bitcoin ledger, what we will see is something like you know, what I depict on this slide. Please don't look at this for syntax. This is just pseudocode or English, just to convey the general idea, not the precise semantics or syntax. So inside each block in this sequence of ledger entries, you will see two things. One, there'll be new coins, new bitcoins minted. So every one of these entries will allow to generate new coins. And the other is a list of payments or transfers of these coins. And the nice thing about this agreement on the ledger is that everybody can look at this sequence and know exactly where the coins are and who owns them. And in Bitcoin's case, the particular model inside each block is what's called unspent transaction outputs, or UTXOs. And that means that each block is kind of self-sufficient. You can see who is the recipient of every payment in a finalized form. So in order for me to say that I own a coin, all I have to do is point to a block in this sequence and show that, you know, a transaction, an approved, validated transaction with me as a recipient exists here. And between that point and, you know, the point that I want to prove, I did not transfer it to anybody else. And anybody that looks from, you know, within this window between two blocks can tell whether I have the coin or not. And so in the example on this slide, everybody can see that Alice has already spent her coin, and therefore she cannot double spend it. But B is okay. B actually still has a coin. So this ledger has a fixed format and a fixed use case. It's used for the shared provenance, the tracking of cryptocurrency payments. A more general purpose ledger is the Ethereum ledger that allows to embed inside every block arbitrary scripts using a scripting language known as EVM. But it could be any Turing complete language with bounded resources. And this allows to express arbitrary logic and build essentially a globally shared program where there's program snippets in each block and they can invoke each other. So in the example here, we show a multi-sig or an escrow example. So one of the main problems with cryptocurrencies is, well, you have a coin, it's a sequence of bits. Now what do you do to keep it? If you have millions of dollars in these coins, what do you do? Do you store it on your hard drive, and then if it's crashed, it's lost? Do you store it in the cloud? Maybe it can get stolen. Is there only one copy of it? And then, you know, it's vulnerable. If there are multiple copies of it, maybe it can be broken into more easily. So one of the key use cases for Ethereum that people have looked at is creating escrow accounts where a bunch of people or a bunch of devices of the same person each have an account. They all set up this joint account where some threshold of them, let's say 2 out of 3, are required to spend any money from this account. So we can see on the second block, I set up this account, and I set up a method that says, okay, here's the method that will allow spending, but invoking it once will not be enough. When you invoke it multiple times with multiple signatures and you pass a certain threshold, then you can actually pass the payment. And later in the ledger, blocks can invoke this multi-sig contract with the right signature. Every time it's invoked, it's counted and until it can be spent. So kind of the main question that everybody wants to know is, it's very exciting. State machine replication is a very powerful tool. It can build anything. What is this good for? What is the killer application for it? And to be completely honest, we see a lot of blockchain wash, is what we call it at VMware. A lot of people that will just throw blockchain on every possible use case. And a lot of activity in this space is just self-generated. So one company wants to have a pilot with blockchain, and another also wants to have a pilot, so they feed each other, and there's a whole industry about these, around these pilots and about these experiments. This is not to say there are no real use cases, but I think that we're in, you know, we're at the point in the hype curve where we're still exploring. I personally am very excited to participate in this exploration. What is emerging out of this exploration is, first of all, let's step back and remember, anything that can be implemented decentralized can also be implemented by a centralized service, obviously. So there needs to be a real compelling use case not to trust a single service provider or a business with commercial reputation and standing behind some service. There needs to be a reason to remove that and not to allow the industry and the economy to drive that. And this is the primary question we ask ourselves when we see all of these use cases. Is there really a need to remove trust and to decentralize the service in such a way that we don't need to trust any component? Some of the prevailing use cases, well, the top two ones were the ones I put as the examples. So cryptocurrencies or utility coins, not just the original Bitcoin or Ethereum, but there's a whole industry now with, you know, 4,000 different coins out there that build on existing infrastructure, or they roll out their own infrastructure and launch new coins with all sorts of properties. The favorite one is probably CryptoKitties. How many people have heard of CryptoKitties? How many people have actually played or downloaded or bought CryptoKitties? Okay, not too many. I have not, and I do not give advice on, you know, whether to buy or sell Bitcoins, CryptoKitties, or anything like that. Just focus on the technical stuff. All sorts of crazy new coins with interesting ways to generate value, and then build an exchange where people buy and sell these coins. And just like any exchange, if people believe in it, then so long as they believe in it, they have value. This is still the number one use of the technology. It was designed for that, and that's the main use case. The second most prevailing use case we see in Ethereum is multisig, is these escrow wallets that guard the coins that were created. Some other interesting use cases. So first of all, a blockchain is a reliable broadcast channel. You could post something there, and it's immutable and very difficult to erase. It's virtually indestructible, you can audit it, and you can prove that whatever you put in the blockchain is there. So people have come up with, you know, a ton of use cases like identity management. I can post and claim some key by posting it to the blockchain. I can revoke keys and so forth. People use it for all sorts of auditable services, for supply chain tracking. And just about anything that leverages the transparency and the immutability of just a broadcast channel. Whether you actually need a decentralized service infrastructure for that or not is a good question. People often don't actually store the full information or don't process the full information on the blockchain. So we saw the blocks can store data, and they can even store programs. But a lot of use cases we see actually store the information and or process it off-chain. And then they just push a hash or some commitment to the chain as a proof or as a way to commit to some value and later be able to open it. And we'll see a little bit more of that soon. Perhaps the most interesting and to me the most compelling reason for the excitement is the blockchain and state machine replication is a platform for harnessing methods from the crypto world that allow, you know, privacy and secure collaborative computations. So there are a lot of good ideas, a lot of methods, and the blockchain is a platform that allows us to incorporate crypto techniques and provide secure computation over a decentralized infrastructure. So for example, if we go back to the contracts, you know, the smart contracts example, and I'll use a slightly different example now. Let's say that I want to use the blockchain to post a self-executing car dealership, car selling contract. So here I have simple contract where I want to sell my car, and this contract is self-executing. It's autonomous. Once I post it and somebody sends me a payment, and let's assume that the car security system actually syncs with the blockchain and responds to transactions, then the car will be sold once somebody actually offers me a payment on the blockchain. But in this particular example, the contract I post is open. All the terms of the contract would be open. And what I'd like is, for example, the minimal price that I'm willing to sell the car to remain secret. So otherwise, nobody will offer me more than my asking price. And only when the payment is actually sent on the blockchain, I want the blockchain to be able to open the payment and compare it to my price and decide whether the deal goes through or not. And likewise, people have looked at payments that keep the actual price private. Only the transacting parties need to know that, not everybody else. Maybe the payee or the payer can remain private. And all sorts of interesting secure computations can take place on the blockchain when you harness crypto methods. So all of this is great. But to go back to the core enabling technology is consensus, is the ability of a decentralized system, a group of nodes, to form agreement on a sequence of blocks in a completely decentralized manner. And in fact, Marc Andreessen already made this insightful observation in an article to the New York Times in 2014. So Marc Andreessen is the founder of, is the inventor of Mosaic. He's a venture capitalist. He's known as a thought leader. And in an article to the New York Times, he said, Bitcoin is the first practical solution to a long-standing problem in computer science called the Byzantine Generals problem. And this was an insightful comment that already made the link between distributed computing and the foundations and, you know, Byzantine agreement. In all that world, and the world of cryptocurrencies. It was also a slightly optimistic remark. And again, to go back to my main takeaway, this remark seems to imply that the problem is solved. And I would argue that there's still a lot of work that we can do as a community. But let's first look at what is the consensus core of Bitcoin. And the core is what's known as Nakamoto consensus. This was published by an anonymous pseudonym, you know, a paper signed by a pseudonym Satoshi Nakamoto in 2008. And it's an algorithm that brings together several ideas that were known already at the time from the academic world, stitches them together in a new way. And it's a triumph. It's a triumph of algorithms, math, crypto. And what do I mean by that? There is no company that was behind this algorithm or this service. There was no company that maintained and debugged it and put its, you know, team of developers or reputation or business interest behind this. And nevertheless, just by harnessing, you know, good algorithmic components and ideas, Nakamoto consensus has been stable for over a decade now. Nobody has been able to essentially collapse it or find any problem. And, you know, so it's been stable and carries, you know, the infrastructure of Bitcoin for over a decade. So this is pretty remarkable. And like I said, there are many ideas from academia. The two main ones that really enable the consensus core in Bitcoin are the following. So the first one is an idea that dates back to 91. Haber and Stornetta had this technology, invented this technology that allows to chain documents. And they wanted to solve a completely different problem. What they wanted is to link documents, historical documents, in such a way that nobody can go back and change any one of them without it, the whole chain collapsing. So all of these documents are linked such that none of them is by itself mutable. And they went on and founded a company a year later, Surety, which allows people to deposit documents into the chain and get this kind of guarantee that now the digest of the document is committed. And they went even further. Not just the company is behind this, but they also publish once a week the tail of the chain to the New York Times, to the Lost and Found section of the New York Times in the Sunday edition. Since 92, this has been going on to this date. In order for this chain to be virtually indestructible, even if the company goes away, even if it's corrupt, even if it's penetrated, there is a record of the hash every week in the New York Times every week, which makes the whole chain secure. And this is the longest running blockchain, if you like, much earlier than Bitcoin. So this is one idea. The second idea that is harnessed to make Bitcoin possible is the idea of cryptographic puzzles that are used to prove that certain work was done and cannot be solved by circumventing that work. And again, this was invented for a completely different purpose by Dvorak and Naor in 92. And they invented it for the purpose of fighting spam. Their idea was that anybody that wants to send mail will have to invest a certain computation. In this way, you cannot spam freely. So the idea in Nakamoto Consensus is to use this proof of work and generate a new coin every period of time, such that it's impossible to speed this up. Every 10 minutes, the algorithm tunes itself automatically such that one coin or one solution, one block can be produced. So both of these techniques were known before. And what Nakamoto Consensus did was this remarkable, this beautiful idea of putting the two together. He said, we will use proof of work to create new coins, but the only way these coins become valid is by linking them and hashing them into a chain. In this way, every block in the chain is now part of this agreement protocol. Everybody is incentivized to agree with this chain because otherwise they don't get value. And you also push other contacts like transactions and payments into this block, get some fees out of it. So there's agreement now in the entire history of newly minted coins and transactions. Now, there's no real consensus guarantee here, and anybody could try and create a different chain. But the beauty is that everybody is incentivized economically to agree with the chain, because if you try to fork it, and everybody else continues with the primary longer chain, then you will be ignored. So essentially, there's economical incentive not to try to compete. Again, there's no real consensus here. At any moment in time, whether you conform, whether out of non-conforming, or whether just by accident, you know, there are two solutions simultaneously, the chain could fork. And that happens. It happens all the time. But after a while, one of these forks become dominant, and everybody agrees that this is the fork, so that this is the right chain. And so while there's no real guarantee of finality, any block that is buried in the chain more than a few levels deep is considered probabilistically to be safe and stable and sort of reaching consensus. So as I said, this is a triumph. This has been stable. This has been a remarkable success, given that you know no company was behind it. It was just an algorithm. But at the same time, there are many, many problems with Nakamoto Consensus. So first of all, by now it has become so successful that the amount of computation that goes into solving these problems is very high. And this is a very big problem in terms of energy cost and the waste of energy. Secondly, as we said, it's fundamentally built on the hardness of producing a new block. So in Bitcoin, every 10 minutes a block is produced. This means very high latency for a consensus decision. And it's also limited in throughput because there's only so much information that can be squeezed into a block every 10 minutes. Now, even with all of that, at the end of the day, we don't get consensus. So forking is possible, and in fact, there's no guarantee. If there's any period of synchrony, and periods of asynchrony, when the communication is cut between two parts of the network, there's really no guarantee. The two parts of the network can fork for as long as the communication is not working properly between them. And there have been forking attacks and forking problems in Bitcoin for up to 48 hours. And there's no reason to think that this won't happen. And perhaps most importantly, at the end of the day, this started as a decentralized algorithm that everybody maintains a copy of and everybody participates in. However, because it has become so difficult to actually participate and compute these crypto puzzles, if you look at the state of existing dominant blockchain infrastructure out there, you see that in all of them, more than 50% is controlled by a handful of players. So it's far, far from decentralized. In fact, if you go to this website, arewedecentralizedyet.com, I went there last night and picked up the numbers on the slide. It tracks the control in these networks of the prominent cryptocurrencies, and it shows that Bitcoin is probably controlled by three main participants. 50% of it is controlled by three. And likewise, Ethereum and Ripple or Stellar, these newer blockchain infrastructures that are supposed to be super scalable, they're controlled by one. 50% of them is controlled by one. So not very scalable. So people are revisiting the academic world and looking for solutions that will help scale the blockchain core, the consensus core. And so they look at both the public or permissionless setting where nobody knows who participates or their number. They look back at the classical setting where there's a known group of participants that are permitted to participate and their credentials are checked. And they're also looking at hybrid, and actually the boundaries between the permissionless and permissioned are blurred. And this is perhaps the most interesting development that we see many, many interesting ideas that tie these two together. So for example, Bitcoin was perhaps the first that took an existing public blockchain and said, let's look at every block that succeeds in entering the chain. And use that as an entry, as a credential to enter a group of participants. So at any moment in time, we have a subcommittee consisting of the tail of the public chain, and then they can use standard consensus techniques within the smaller subcommittee to make decisions, to drive throughput higher, to drive finality faster, and to provide certain guarantees. Other people have looked at not having a public blockchain at all, but just using proof of work as a way to rotate a subcommittee. So we've done work called Solida that uses this idea. There are ideas for selecting subcommittee out of a permissionless setting that don't look at proof of work at all. So Algorand, for example, is a known algorithm that uses crypto to select a subcommittee. And there are other hybrid approaches that uses stake. So instead of looking at entities or principles on the blockchain, you look at their value in cryptocurrency and use that as a permission to form a subcommittee. So all of these are interesting ideas, and the common part in all of them is that you end up with a subcommittee, permissioned or somehow otherwise rotated, that needs to form consensus decisions and output this ledger, this sequence of blocks. So this is great. This means that I can come to this audience and talk about consensus. I've been doing it for 3 decades now. Difference is, I used to have 3 people that were interested in consensus, and now the whole world is a consensus fan. So let me talk about consensus now and switch gears to the technical part of this talk. And I'll try to do it in a way that actually borrows and intertwines the blockchain world with the classical foundations. So we're going to start with a careful problem definitions of what we want to solve. What is the problem, and what are the properties, and what are the guarantees that we actually want? So in the academic world, what we have is a problem in a distributed system with a number of participants n, such that less than a third of them is presumed to be Byzantine faulty, meaning they could crash, but they could also behave arbitrarily. We assume that participants know each other and can send messages to each other in an authenticated manner. And the problem, the consensus problem, is fundamentally for them to agree on a value, or more generally in a multi-consensus, they want to agree on a sequence of values. So this is the agreement part. We want to have liveness. There has to be progress in the protocol. And anything that we agree on has to be a valid value in this that was proposed to this engine. Now, very importantly, we're going to look at asynchronous solutions that guarantee the safety even if the communication breaks or even if the network partitioned. They always maintain safety, and they progress at the speed of the network. They don't wait for some external clock or some fixed periods to make progress. So we're interested in solutions that are not going to break safety, even if there's some timing violations, because we want them to scale to very large internets and potentially geo-distributed settings. And we don't want communication disruptions to break the consensus. However, this is well known to be unsolvable, provably unsolvable problem. So what we want is that only liveness, only progress, will actually depend on timely communication. And so this is known in the literature as the partial synchrony model. We're going to assume that every once in a while the system goes through periods where it behaves well, and there is a known bound on communication. Let's call it delta. And it can go in and out of these periods unexpectedly, but the participants can wait for time delta when they need to. And I'm going to start with the landmark solution of asynchronous Byzantine agreement by Dwork, Lynch, and Stockmeyer from 1988. And this was the first asynchronous consensus solution in this model. So just out of curiosity, how many people in this audience have read the DLS paper? Okay, I saw 2 hands, maybe I missed. Out of the 2, or whoever else I made, did you actually read the Byzantine part, or only the crash tolerance part? You did read the Byzantine. Okay, we have one saint in the audience. For the rest of you, I'm going to teach you the DLS solution in the next 3-4 minutes. So if there's nothing you take away from this talk, you'll get a blitz tutorial to really this beautiful landmark idea. So remember, we have a system which is asynchronous. We have N parties, out of which less than a third are faulty. So we're going to depict them in this time chart with four participants. The most one is Byzantine faulty. And there's no bound on communication. So the most we can do is wait for three out of four responses. The other one may be crashed. So what DLS showed is you can always maintain safety in this setting. And it's actually very simple to maintain safety. The protocol works in a rotation of rounds. In each round, there's a proposer. The proposer proposes some value. In this case, the proposal is the value zero, and waits until it gets 2F plus 1 out of the 3F plus 1s to get locked on this value. If they do, if it gets responses, votes from 2F plus 1 out of the 3F plus 1, then it can go away and decide. And then starts another rotation with a new proposer. And the new proposer can propose the same value. It will also get votes and get locked and will walk away with a decision. Or if it tries to propose a different value, then we have at least one correct participant in the overlap between the first proposer and the second one that will not vote, you know, will refuse to vote for a conflicting value. And therefore, you cannot get 2F plus 1 votes or what we call a quorum certificate for a conflicting value. So safety is trivial to maintain even in this setting. Just by getting the votes of a quorum, you can never get two quorums to approve two conflicting values. Now, obviously, we have a problem with liveness. Not with the protocol, with the audience. So as soon as I put this time chart, people were on their phones and laptops like, oh my god, this distributed consensus. What am I doing here? And this is what James Mickens already referred to as the saddest moment in an article from 2013, where he kind of drew this caricature, saying, you know, it takes a lot of expertise. These protocols are pretty subtle. They're difficult to understand. They're bug-prone, and really, only experts can improve on them. But at the same time, we have Nakamoto consensus, which was remarkably simple. Every 10 minutes, you just broadcast one new value, and that's it. You get consensus. So you kind of wish you could bring the two worlds together. And I'll try to do this in the 10, 13 minutes that I have left. And to do this, I'm going to harness really nice ideas and innovation from the blockchain world, and bring them into the Byzantine consensus or BFT academic world. So I'm going to borrow what Tendermint and Ethan Bachman did in his thesis, then was adopted by Casper, the friendly finality gadget from Ethereum. And then we obviously had to respond with Hot Stuff, the linear BFT devil. And all this will be a framework that brings together Byzantine consensus and blockchains. So instead of having a time chart and messages and explicit explicit messaging and explicit protocol going on, instead, what we're going to do is we're going to concentrate on the proposals. This is the only thing that matters. So these proposals, which are the squares here, operate to form a chain. So each proposal has a height and links to previous proposals. All we care about is whether a proposal is finalized, whether it reaches a decision or not. So we will have some votes or some protocol, but we don't really care at this point about the messages or the protocol. We only care about whether some invariant is satisfied so that the block has a decision. And if it has a decision, we want to guarantee that only blocks that continue that chain can actually be accepted. So if somebody tries to fork and create a different chain, they'll be rejected. So we don't really care if these are new proposals or they're all just steps of the same protocol not adding any new value. It really doesn't matter. Every step of the protocol is just going to be one of these blocks. And then there'll be some voting that determines whether you can accept this block as a decision or not. And in order to make a safe decision, you have to continue the same chain. Otherwise, the protocol has to prevent any forking. Now, since we operate in these rounds, you might as well put new information in each one of these blocks. Maybe you could put them to some good news. So every step of the protocol can add new proposal, but it doesn't matter. What we care is, the only thing we care about is that there's only one chain that continues, and you can only add blocks to the same chain without ever forking. This is the consensus property. So now to go back to DLS, what we can see is that the protocol maintains safety in a very simple way. Every height a proposal is made, votes are made on the proposal, and there cannot be at the same height two proposals that are conflicting because they cannot both obtain 2F+1 votes. And if we apply this rule that a chain can continue only if there's no decision on a previous on a conflicting fork, then we get the consensus that we need out of DLS. Every proposer has to add to the tail of the current chain that has 2F+1 votes. It cannot add to a different tail that conflicts with it. And that's it. That's enough to maintain safety and to guarantee that only one of these chains ever succeeds. And it also looks pretty similar to Nakamoto consensus. So the difference is, in Nakamoto consensus, we don't have 3F+1. We don't have explicit quorums. What we have is kind of an implicit and probabilistic vote counting. And this is my best attempt at bringing Nakamoto consensus to the BFT world. When you look at what's going on, by solving a proof of work puzzle, you get a probabilistic evidence that a lot of participants were working on the particular chain that they're lengthening. Now, you don't get a guarantee that it's 2F+1. There's not even a count of the members. But you get a pretty good, you know, probabilistic guarantee that a lot accepted the current chain and continued the tail. Now, as we already said, there could be forks. So it's only, you know, with some probability representing acceptance or votes by everybody. But once you repeat this over and over, these probabilities are reinforcing one after another. And so now you get a chain where every block represents the vote that a large fraction of the participants put into that fork. Each one of them statistically, you know, probabilistically says, yes, they think it's the tail. And so the probability that they're all extending the tail of a chain without having a majority becomes increasingly small. And so again, after burying a block for a few levels deep, you get a probabilistic guarantee that now so many of the participants are extending the same chain that it's like a guarantee that 2F+1 have voted for it, or a quorum. So first of all, before I continue, kind of the before and after, hopefully you like this mapping. Hopefully you like the hot stuff framework for expressing Byzantine algorithms a little better than the previous one. Now, to very quickly go back to the liveness problem of DLS, not the audience, yes, you could have forks that each get some fraction of the votes, such that none of the forks get a quorum. And this is now very easy to see. Both the top fork and the bottom fork get F+1 votes, and that's it. None of them can get a quorum. So to get around that, Protocols need what I would call aliveness gadget. So at the beginning of every new height, there needs to be some information that guides the proposer which one of the forks is in fact safe. And this is the core of these protocols. In DLS, it's simply an all-to-all double exchange of all the votes and all the locks that guarantee, and that's a little bit subtle to see, but it does guarantee that a correct proposer always picks the safe branch, the safe tail to extend. And then if we reach the point where the system is synchronous, we will also get progress. So with this began kind of a cottage industry of BFT protocols that essentially implement this liveness gadget inside the protocol in various ways that try to make it practical. They didn't quite express it this way. They didn't separate the liveness gadget from the proposals, but this is what the Hot Stuff framework allows to express. Now, starting with the DLS solution, this liveness gadget was used to demonstrate that an asynchronous solution is possible, but it wasn't meant as a practical solution. So it would take N rotations, N proposal rotations, to reach a decision, even under the best possible terms, where the system is synchronous, behaving synchronously right from the beginning, and no failures occur, and everything is fine. Even under this best possible situation, DLS will require N proposal rotations to terminate. Each one of these rotations takes the maximal bound known for synchrony to exchange information for liveness. And the amount of signed messages, authenticated values that are exchanged in the process would be N to the 4. So it took about, it took over 10 years for Castro and Liskov to improve on DLS and produce the first practical solution, PBFT, that essentially took and implemented this liveness gadget instead of with an all-to-all exchange by having a leader collect all this information and then use it as a proof for the next proposal. So this improved the standard common case where the leader is not faulty, where the leader is stable, so the decision can be carried in essentially one leader rotation. But still, to actually cope with up to F failures, even when the system is synchronous, when the system is asynchronous, it can obviously run forever, it's impossible to solve. But even when we've reached synchrony, it can take N to the 4 transmitted values in PBFT to complete a single consensus decision. Very recently, innovation coming from the blockchain world, Tendermint and Casper, modified the liveness gadget and changed the trade-off so that this is reduced to n to the 3 messages, but at the cost of returning back to the DLS synchronous rounds. So to guarantee that a leader has all information, it has to wait for the worst communication bound. In between these innovations came Ziziva in 2007, which was a protocol that introduced an optimistically fast track in the case where not only is the leader stable, but also there are absolutely no failures and all responses arrive to the leader. And so they've actually introduced a linear protocol during the normal case. But in face of failures and leader rotations, Ziziva essentially falls back to PBFT. Not only that, Ziziva turns out to be flawed and unsafe. We'll get to that in a second. So one trick that has recently in the blockchain been applied to all of these is whenever we collect information, votes from all participants or from a quorum of participants, we can use signature combining techniques from the crypto world to turn N values into a single value that represents all of them. So using this is a known technique in the Byzantine protocols literature. It was employed probably for the first time by BizCoin in 2016 to drive all communication costs by a factor of N down more. And then recently in a protocol called SBFT for scalable BFT, we've also employed these threshold signatures to remove even more factors of N from more steps of the protocol. But still, leader rotation, anytime a leader has to be replaced, remains the Achilles heel of all these protocols. So at the end of the day, as a community, we're left with essentially, you know, this conundrum. We can either choose delta delay for progress, so we have to wait for proof of work or something like that to solve some hard puzzle every 10 minutes. And we have to wait for the worst case communication bound, which in the internet could be in the minutes, to guarantee the safety of the protocol and have a linear communication. Or we have these protocols which normally are pretty good. They advance pretty fast, they're pretty practical, but every once in a while you might stop and pay a cubic number of messages, N to the 3. Now, why do we care about these theoretical complexities? Well, because these protocols were invented for systems that were envisioned to have, you know, maybe 4 nodes, maybe 7 nodes. But nowadays, we're talking about running these committees out of a public blockchain that require hundreds, maybe thousands of participants. So for something like 2,000 participants, every once in a while, we would need to stop and wait for 8 billion signed messages to be sent. That's a lot of signed messages. And so even if these protocols are pretty practical on average, they have this lurking time bomb that really makes all the existing infrastructure struggle. So here's the same kind of message on a timeline. We started with DLS in 88, solving the Byzantine generals problem, improved to a practical solution in the common case in PBFT, tried to get an even better optimistic track in Ziziva and failed, fixed it and introduced some optimizations in SBFT by us at VMware this year. And up until now, remained with these cubic solutions. Now, when I was invited to give this keynote, we didn't have any further news, but luckily 2 weeks ago, we were able to remove the cubic complexity altogether, and we now finally have a quadratic solution. That means a solution which is linear, just like Nakamoto consensus. All you have to do is send a message to everybody. That's obviously linear. And pay a worst case N squared communication when faced with cascading failures. And this is the best you can hope for. Even synchronous solutions have to pay N squared in face of F failures. So look forward to the newest member of the Hot Stuff framework that solves this. And very quickly, let me kind of wrap up and ask, so where are we as a community? So I already mentioned, these things are subtle. Byzantine consensus needs experts. We've just recently exposed safety bugs, which we posted to the archive in Ziziva and all the line of works that preceded it and are based on it. So Ziziva was supposed to be the last word in Byzantine solutions. It's also the last word in the English dictionary, and it's actually flawed. This is not the only one. Our friends at IBM posted a survey of blockchain consensus protocols, finding and recommending much more rigor and much more scrutiny. And they, for example, found a liveness bug in Tendermint and a lot of underspecified protocols out there. IBM itself, when it rolled out its first blockchain solution, contributed to the Linux Foundation Hyperledger Consortium, rolled it out without a Byzantine consensus engine. And again, they're not the only ones. If you look at JPMC Chase, they rolled out their Chrome solution with a BFT engine that they later retracted and now fell back to either benign replication solutions or some open source systems that were contributed to Ethereum. So generally, BFT consensus is not for the faint of heart. It's not easy to get these things right. We do have our own favorite engine. We have been building for the last 3 years at VMware an engine called SBFT. It's doing pretty well. We can run it on a wide area network, on 30 Amazon zones, hundreds of nodes, get reasonable throughput. It's 30x times the throughput that you get from current public blockchains like Ethereum. And it has instant, almost immediate finality, which is 1,000 times better, faster than Bitcoin. It's okay. It still doesn't have the quadratic proposer rotation implemented in it. And still, as a community, I would say that we didn't quite succeed yet in producing a common, de facto, successful Byzantine consensus infrastructure. And so kind of I want to wrap up with a slide that we show the executives at VMware and succeeded in convincing them that there's an opportunity and there's a challenge that companies like VMware and other places that have the combined expertise and experience needed to build these platforms for decentralized trust in a serious manner. We've convinced VMware, hopefully other places can also work. Fundamentally, this is a new type of database, and it has far more decentralization and security and expressivity than existing databases. And even traditional databases typically take a decade at least to mature. So as a community, we have a lot of challenges in scaling, sharding, adjusting to workloads, building industrial-grade infrastructure for decentralized trust. And so with this takeaway message, I want to wrap up and open for any questions. So any questions other than when to buy and sell Bitcoin, you're welcome.
Hi, Dali. Nice talk. I'm surprised I'm the only one standing at the mic. Maybe people are just too eager for the break. Fred Douglas, Perspective Labs. So I'm curious about your take on what's happened with some of these hacks where somebody has sort of a leaky Ethereum contract in a big bank or something. People come in, they drain it, and there are millions of dollars lost. And they come back and say, oh, you know what? We're going to fork it and we're going to fix it. What does that do to the trust of the community for the other transactions that people thought were nice and secure and established in blockchain?
Good question. Not sure I have an answer. First of all, the fundamental consensus engine of Bitcoin and Ethereum have not been broken. They've been stable. What has been broken into so far are the applications that were built with smart contract languages and some of the mechanisms that were put in place to secure them. And that does not enjoy the same, I think, experience, history, and rigor that the basic consensus engine does. And definitely the people who build distributed apps or dApps on top of Ethereum, I think every single one of them has been broken into already. That requires a lot of work as a community to build the, I don't know, the culture, the know-how, the expertise of building secure, decentralized services on top of the infrastructure. My talk obviously concentrated on providing the best infrastructure, but there's a lot of other layers as well. Yeah. Yeah, Ben.
Yeah, I was wondering, perhaps I missed this, but a couple of times you referred to F, like the number of failures, and you referred to majority. But if you don't know who's out there, like you don't know your membership, how do you talk about majority and F?
Yeah, not majority, but quorum, two-thirds majority, supermajority, yeah. Quorum. So F was when I switched gears and said, okay, we're relevant. This is our world. In our world, we do have a known membership set, a known group of participants. We denote them by N, and N equals 3F plus 1, meaning we assume, and this is the guarantee, that if less than a third are malicious, then safety will be preserved. And the only thing I say is this translates to the blockchain world or the public blockchain, the permissionless world. First of all, there you don't have an explicit count, but you may have things like, okay, how much power is controlled? How much compute power? How much stake, if you have stake-based protocols? How many recent, if you have subcommittees, how many recent miners could be faulty when you form a subcommittee out of them? So that's first, you have to translate N and F into power or stake. And secondly, understand that Nakamoto consensus does not really give you a guarantee. It gives you a probabilistic guarantee. You think that a unique proposer expresses what a lot believe in. You think. It's a probabilistic guarantee. And when another block is appended, another, and everybody are extending the same tail, then each one of them is expressing a probabilistic aggregate vote. But it's only probabilistic. There's no real guarantee. This is one of the reasons people are now looking back at academic solutions and ingredients for stronger guarantees.